There are good signs that we're improving productivity, which of course is a holy grail of organizations. We are actually improving productivity in the NHS using solution-focused practice. And we've only just begun.
Hello and welcome to the Towards Solution podcast, where creativity meets practical application. I'm Dion Singh.
And I'm Jason Pascoe. Together, we dive deep into the world of solution focus, exploring its transformative power across a variety of contexts.
Come join us each month as we engage in enlightening conversations with experts and practitioners who are applying solution focus in their unique environments. Whether you're looking to enhance your personal life, professional practice, or community projects, our discussions will provide you with valuable insights and actionable ideas.
Tune in to discover how you can implement solution-focused strategies and practices in your own context, unlocking new possibilities and creative solutions. Let's embark on this journey of exploration and innovation together. Subscribe now so you don't miss an episode of the Towards Solutions podcast.
Yeah, it's fun. I think we're going to have a fun conversation today.
It's already begun. Welcome, Andrew Gibson. Thank you so much for taking us up on the invite to come and have a chat. I think I first learned about you or heard of you. Actually, it was Jason, I think, who recommended "What's Your URP" to me. The book that you wrote, I'm sure we'll talk about this down the track. But I got the audio version, and I listened to it, and it really fitted with my values and the way that I approach the kind of work I do. And it kind of, I don't know, I sometimes think, I just agree. I like people that I agree with, but I don't know if that's the case, but could quite well be the case. But it really spurred me on in what I was probably already doing and ways I was thinking in, genuine ways of building connections with people and then how you can, mutually benefit. So that was kind of where I come across you. And then I enjoyed the book enough, and I wanted to kind of hold it and read it. So I own a physical copy. And you also, we met recently on the at the sponsors meeting for the Journal of Solution Focused Practices, because you also head up the operation side and manage the operations for the Journal of Solution Focused Practices. So outside of that, I must confess, I don't really know a whole lot about you, but I also think, might be good going into a conversation, because it's we get to be curious and enjoy our conversation. So thanks for joining us.
And thank you for your kind comments about what's your URP as well. That's good to know that there are at least two people who've bought it and read it. That's good news. So, yeah, the whole thing about writing what's your URP was to bring solution-focused practice to help people who were looking to start businesses. I found in my coaching life, I've helped a lot of people start businesses, either directly or through helping coaches who are working in deprived communities, especially in Bradford, which is a city near me here in Leeds in the UK, and also over in Manchester. And the coaches, through networking in communities, find people who want to explore starting a business. The beauty of the project is that when it's run properly, is that it's not about the starting of the business, it's about the exploring of the starting of the business. Mm-hmm. And a good outcome is to explore it and decide it's not for you. That's better than starting it and spending lots of time and money, maybe borrowing money, maybe entering into contracts and stuff, and then finding out it's not for you. That's how you get in a whole heap of trouble. And what I found was people, when they start a business, I'm sure this will be familiar to lots of people listening to this, when you start a business, you just want to get some money in. You just want to get some customers, don't you? So when people say, so who do you help? How, and who can I introduce you to? Anyone. And okay, and what are you going to do for anyone? Anything. And it's like, yeah, okay. And it's kind of like, going into a travel agent and saying, I want to go on holiday. And the travel agent says, yep, well, you're a travel agent. You're in the right place. Where do you want to go? Anywhere. Okay, the travel agent's going to ask you to narrow it down a bit, aren't they? And then they're going to want to find out what kind of holiday you want and what your budget is and who else is going with you. And all these other details help them to craft the perfect holiday for you. And it's the same for us in business. We actually have to think really specifically about who we help and how we help them and the difference we make for them, which is, this is where the solution focused practice bit comes in. People buy the difference that you make after you've done your thing. They don't want the thing that you do, unless it's really obvious that they need that thing. And so they buy the difference that you make. So you need to lead with the difference that you make, and you need to go and present that difference in whatever is the most appropriate way to the people who are most likely to need that difference. And that accelerates your new business, or indeed your existing business, in terms of finding people to help and bringing some money in for your business. So that's what that book was all about. So I'm delighted that you guys have read it and enjoyed it, and thank you very much.
I love it. So, Andrew, I can see that you love what you do because I can see the sparkle in your eyes as you talk about what you do and how SF has impacted it. And I love the fact that we learn, it's like this thing we learn about and then we go, look at the possibilities with this. What is it about solution focus that you love?
I think, well, it's now just become the way I live my life, okay? And has been for many, many years, because it just makes sense. And I think the key to solution focused practice is to realize that it is common sense, but common sense codified. Okay? We have an understanding of how common sense works in a world that has abandoned common sense for usually selfish reasons. Okay, so this is my take on things, and if anybody out there can help me turn this into a research project, I'd love to hear from them. This is again, so I wasn't around in prehistoric times, but let's just imagine that we were a little tribe. And we were hungry, okay? And we decided that we wanted to go out and get something for our tea. And we quite fancied a bit of wild boar, yeah? So we're gonna go out and we're gonna hunt a wild boar. And we go out and we're hunting wild boar. And we fail to find a wild boar, okay? What would we do? Naturally, what would we do? Well, we'd probably go and eat something else, yeah? We would go and eat some fruit or some vegetables, we'd grub up some roots or something like that. And we'd have something else for our tea. And we'd go back the next day and maybe say, well, we're going to try and find a wild boar again. And then the equivalent of that in the modern world is when we fail to find a wild boar, we form a committee and we analyze all the reasons that we failed to find a wild boar. And then we go and look for, big complex solutions where we say, well, let's build traps, let's build devices that will help us to catch the wild boar. And we spend all this time. No, by the time we've done all this, we've died of starvation. So it's common sense to go and do something else. If the first thing isn't working, just go and do something else. But there's an awful lot of people who will sell you the wild boar trapping and hunting solution system, and it's overcomplicated for the purpose, which is actually to help people to satisfy their hunger. And over the years, we've lost sight of that for lots and lots of reasons. One of them, I think, is actually because solution-focused practice is just too simple and too effective for people to make money doing it. And we live in a world where you need to make money. And there's loads of people, for example, who are doing brilliant work with single-session coaching. I know there's a lot of that in Australia. There's a lot of that all over. But in a world where you're paid by the session rather than paid for the outcomes, you make more money if you do 12 sessions than if you do one session. So the incentive for the coach is to sign people up to their 12 session program, when actually the difference is better for the client if they're helped in one. So we've moved away from that sounds really obvious when you state it, but you try persuading a client to pay you more for one session than they would for 12. So we've moved away from that common sense world. And solution focused practice for me is unlocking common sense. And it's really essentially very, very simple. And if we remember that it's very simple, then we will do ourselves well in trying to persuade this overcomplicated world that there is actually a simple way of doing it, and they can learn it very, very quickly and very, very easily. And once they've learned it and started to apply it, they'll see that it's pretty obvious that this is actually a better way of doing things.
Very nice.
Wow.
I'm interested in where did you come across Solution Focus? What was your journey into Solution Focus?
So my journey really was one of good fortune. I started my career in the traditional way. I went to university and did an engineering degree because that would get me a job. I then went and got a job in big business, and worked in big business through management training schemes. Worked for Unilever, worked for a big brewery, which is up here in Leeds. They're now part of Molson Coors. And I worked for them for the first, oh gosh, 15, 16, 17 years of my career. And then kind of got to the point where I thought, is this it? I was in my mid-30s and I could see I had some lovely colleagues, but they were all in their fifth early, the ones who were around about 50, all they were talking about was how much fun they were going to have when they retired. And I was looking at my career path and thinking, well, am I going to wait for another 25 years before I have fun? Okay. So I took the decision to step away without really having a plan. I thought it's about time I just opened up and see what comes to me. And what came to me was a job as a coach working in Bradford in an area called Holmwood and West Bowling, which is a community which has a lot of support put into it, but it's one of those communities which always seems to struggle. And I was sent in there to help people start businesses. It was a project called BizFizz. It was a fantastic project. The coaching was pure coaching, so we were not allowed to give advice. We pulled together a network of local people to offer advice when it was needed, and then we would anonymize that advice and return it to the client so that we were maintained our pure coaching approach. And they taught me the GROW model. So we were talking about the GROW model earlier, Jason. I was taught the GROW model and I was off with the GROW model. This is fantastic. My fifth client was a very dear chap called Greg Vinicum. Some people listening to this will have heard of Greg. Sadly, he's no longer with us. He went away on holiday and was sadly run over and killed in a really bad accident over there about 10, 11 years ago. So here, this is to his memory, really. And Greg was introduced to me. We hit it off. We both come from Aberdeen in the northeast of Scotland. We're both supporters of the football club that hails from those parts. We became really good mates, and he introduced me to Solution Focused Practice. And it was one of those where there's me, this wet behind the ears coach with the GROW model at my disposal, and he was setting up a training and consultancy business, which is still going to this day. It's being run by his friends that he was helping with, people like John Wheeler and so on. And he was talking about solution focused practice. I think at the time he was president of the UK Association, a bit like yourself, Dion. Really presenting me with all these things that I'd never heard of and all these honorific titles. I'm thinking, oh my goodness, how am I going to help him? Anyway, we had a really good conversation. Helped to make some progress, and yeah, we became good friends. And he introduced me to the world of solution focused practice. He introduced me to the UK Association, so I went to my first conference up in Edinburgh, which I think was around 2011, I think. And I've carried on in the world of SF ever since. And really, my journey of development in SF is very much down to Greg. I've also, like you've been in the beneficiary of lots of help from lots of the great people in our community who are also giving of their time and of their enthusiasm for the practice. And I've gradually developed my take on the simplicity and the essence of SF, and I've chosen to apply it with people who need help. Especially people who are helping others who need help, rather than going after people who want to make more money, because when somebody's making a million, why do they need to make more millions? That doesn't make sense to me. So I mainly work with charities, local authorities, and the National Health Service, and I'm really happy doing it. It It's a blessing that I found myself in this place, because had I carried on in the traditional career path, I'm in my late 50s now. I would be, I'd be counting the days to my retirement and then wondering what to do with myself. And actually, I've had a fantastic time these last nearly 20 years, in the solution focused world, bringing my take on solution focused practice and learning from the best and helping to hopefully move it forward. And yeah, I absolutely love what I do, and I look forward to it every day. So I think that's the best way to live your life, really.
Yeah, absolutely. In that 20 years, what's been the most fun thing that you've seen with solution focus?
I think probably what I'm doing now, there's every it's all been fun. Where I'm at now, particularly the project I'm doing with the National Health Service here, so local to me here in Yorkshire is South West Yorkshire NHS Foundation Trust. So that's a community health and mental health trust. They've got about 5,000 staff, I think, in total. So they're a fairly chunky organisation. And for the last couple of years, I've been training solution-focused practice there. And I'm training team leaders and first-level managers in order to help them to cope with impossible workloads. And the solution to that is to train them in solution-focused practice. I think you mentioned earlier, Jason, that when you started, you learned the GROW model, and then you learned solution-focused practice, and that saved you 25% of your coaching time. Well, training solution-focused practice in organizations is helping those people who are in this kind of squeezed middle to cope with the impossible demands by giving them tools that help them to deal with things more quickly, and also that help them to not take everything off their team and try and fix it for them, which is a real light bulb moment when people on the training realize that they don't have to do that anymore. It's fantastic. So, and I'm getting great feedback. There are good signs that we're improving productivity, which of course is a holy grail of organizations. We are actually improving productivity in the NHS using solution focused practice. And we've only just begun. We've barely trained maybe a couple hundred people so far, and there's, I think, some enthusiasm to keep on going, and we're looking at, hopefully, this is maybe a bit of a dream, but I've got some other people that I've been chatting to, and maybe, just maybe, we'll be revolutionising the whole NHS at one point and turning them all into a solution-focused practice organisation. So that would be fun. So that's my mission at the moment. So it keeps me busy.
So we were talking before, Andrew, about, day one, you kind of teach them the GROW model, then you can't, then you teach them about SF. Are you saying they're seeing differences in productivity from 2 days of training?
Well, I still use Greg's structure because it works. So it's a 2 day followed by a gap, then a 1 day. Okay. And so yeah, what I'm doing. So to put it in some kind of context, the National Health Service is a problem-focused organization. Okay. And health services are, and they need to be. We present with, so I've got a cold right now, as you can probably tell. So if they've got really bad, I'd go to the doctor. The doctor is the expert in the room. They diagnose my illness. Tell me it's just a cold, go and have a honey and lemon and get some sleep, yeah? Or they might say, actually, it's this, we're going to do some tests and it's this illness and we can prescribe this cure for this illness. They're used to taking people's problems from them and fixing them. They offer the solution and they fix them. So of course, naturally, in organizations, again, clinical people rise through the organization as they develop their skill, but they also assume supervisory and management responsibility. And unfortunately, we don't see that as a skill necessarily. And the NHS has got some fantastic development courses, for people who they want to progress, and they invest a lot of time and effort in developing people organizationally. But they still have this problem mentality, which is when a team member comes to them and says, I've got a problem, what the team member wants is for the team manager to give them a solution. or to take the problem away. And one of the most commonly overused phrases on the NHS, I think, is leave it with me. And so you've got a whole load of team leaders and first level managers who are being swamped by demands from their team. And then they're also being told from their bosses, right, you need to do this. You need to get your team to do this. And here's what we want you to do. And the commands are cascaded from above. And they're just being completely overwhelmed. And it in training them solution-focused practice in an organizational way. So there's been a huge amount of training. I believe that trying to do with my little outpost up here is to look at it organizationally rather than clinically, and to help them to see that they don't have to take things from their staff. Okay, they can actually help their staff to work out what they want and work out some next steps towards it. So the structure of the training, quite deliberately, is about recognizing where they're starting from and moving them slowly to the point where they can do that. Yeah, because you can't just go in. I don't think I can go in and just train them a solution-focused practice and that's it, they're going to get it. So the first day, I train them coaching skills. And it's a universal model. The GROW model is a universal model. So I get them confident in coaching, and through teaching them the GROW model, for anybody who's not familiar with it, by the way, that's goals, reality, resources, options, and will. And so the structure of the conversation is very much, so what do you want to do? Okay, what have you got that's already helping you? And where are you now? Okay, what are your options for making progress? Okay, which of those options do you want to do? And when are you going to do it? And it's an action-oriented coaching conversation, but I get them to learn that structure. I get them asking open questions. I get them listening actively. And I also get them summarizing in the client's language. So those are the things we do on the first day. And then on the second day, I take it into the solution-focused practice world, where we use descriptive language rather than action-oriented language. And this for me is one of the essential differences of solution-focused practice. And I think we kind of owe it to ourselves to keep it really simple. If you're having an action-oriented conversation, then that's not a solution-focused practice conversation. If you're having a difference-oriented conversation, noticeable difference-oriented conversation, that is a solution-focused practice conversation, and the actions emerge at the end. And that's something which I then train. But the structure of traveling in time, so going to your perfect future and describing what you want in great detail, then coming back to the here and now to see if any of it is happening already or if any of it has happened in the past, then working out your next small steps to make progress towards what you want, and then the actions emerging from that as you make those next small steps. That's actually the same structure as the GROW model, if you think about it, because describing what you want in the future is a description of your goal. Looking to see if any of it's happened now in the recent past is reality resources. Looking at your next small steps towards what you want is exploring your options. And then the actions emerge at the end, and actually you just, in most conversations run that way, it's fairly obvious what you want to do next and or where you're going to focus your time and effort. It fits the GROW model really well. So all I have to do on the second day is to get people practicing descriptive language, and I place it in the context of really spending shifting the balance of the conversation away from accepting what the client wants as long as it's ethical and legal, and you know, we just accept it and say, okay, let's crack on. In a solution-focused practice, we spend a lot more time expanding on the what we want. And when you do it on the second day, you can then make it really quite quick, because one of the best questions when a team member hits their boss with a problem is just to say, okay, well, what do we want instead? Or, okay, you've told me about the problem. When is the problem not there? What's happening then? And you can get people using rapid solution-focused practice to help them refocus the conversation on what's wanted rather than what's not wanted. So that's day one and day two. And then I give them a gap of about 4 weeks so they can go and practice. And on the third day, we then review their practice. So the morning is just simply them telling me, okay, what their experience has been, good or bad, and we review it together. We do some refresher training. And then in the afternoon, I teach them how to use this with their team It's out there on SFIO. I've done a couple of talks on this. The best year ever workshop that I do. Excuse me. That is basically that structure of describing what you want. So the best year ever is just, well, 12 months from now, and then looking to see if any of it's happening already, and then next small steps. But doing it in a team context, and I train them how to do that so that they can then use this not only with individuals but use it with their team. And that's the training. That's it. And it's empowering the these middle managers to actually not take all of their team's problems from them, but instead to help their teams to stop complaining about the things that aren't working and start looking for what is, and make progress towards it. It's helping them also, though, when they're receiving commands, when they're so I talk about demands and commands on the training. So they're getting lots of demands from the team and they're getting lots of commands from above. And it's helping them to respectfully say to their bosses, "That's fantastic, boss. Yep, I'll take that and we'll get on with it." Just to help me, though, presuming that we do this really, really well, what will you notice that will tell you that we're doing this really well? That's a very respectful question. Another one is, okay, so after we've done this, what's the difference that you're looking for? Now, that's not quite a solution-focused question, but that's, well, what's the difference you're looking for? We want the boss to actually say what difference they want us to make. And then that enables the team leader to go away and maybe put their own spin on how it gets done, rather than what happens with most action-oriented commands, where it's, right, here's what I want you to do, and here's how I want you to do it. Which makes no sense. It would be that's about as much sense as the three of us going for a meal, and I will tell you what you're having for your tea. Give me the menus. I'm ordering for Jason and Dion. What? So, again, common sense. Why would you wouldn't do that in a restaurant? So why would you do it in an office or an organization? So that's the structure of the training, and it's helping in a number of ways. There's one of the really interesting ways is there's so I think there's two ways that it's working in improving capacity, and this is something I'm hoping that they'll help me with some research in the next round of training that we do. The first is the leave it with me is changing. So team managers are feeling are now have something they can use in the moment, which is okay, not leave it with me, but actually, okay, what do we want instead? Or when's the problem not there? And they're immediately able to get the colleague who's come to them with the problem to start thinking about ways that the colleague can actually make progress.
Well, it makes me think about one of the articles in the journal that was research done in Japan about leaders using more solution-focused language, improving followership.
But it is all about the language, and fundamentally, the doing of something is where we fall out. It's where we have problems. And if we haven't worked out the difference that we want, we're never going to get a solution because we all have to have the same difference. We all have to want the same difference. Then we can debate how we do it, rather than well, we're all going to do something. And organizations are that run on a command and control basis. Where it's all about the doing of stuff, often make a mess of things and then end up undoing the stuff that they've done because it didn't give them the difference that they want. So what we're doing here is training them to work out the difference that they want first. That just makes sense. The second aspect, so the first is to leave it with me. The second is the reluctant team member. Okay. Virtually everybody who comes on this training is a team leader. And indeed, some of them are quite senior managers. So I asked them, have any of you guys got a reluctant team member? Oh, yes. They say, oh, God. And then they all have this team member, some of them have more than one, who just for whatever reason doesn't want to be there. But they're very happy to pocket the salary, they're very happy to turn up, but they just don't do anything. And they're the ones who are constantly coming up with stuff that they throw at the boss as a way of avoiding them actually doing any work. And the traditional approach, of course, is, well, you need to change them, you need to sort them out, you need to go and work with them. And the team leader is directed to go and work with the problem member and fix them. Sound familiar? And of course, that just doesn't work. And meanwhile, the rest of the team gets less of the team leader's time. And so they feel neglected. And actually, the performance of the team suffers because they're not getting the support that they need. And the reluctant team members get all the time. So, of course, solution-focused practice, and especially the third day, the best year ever training, helps the team leader to work with the willing and use the whole team to create that description of their perfect future 12 months from now, have a look and see what's working already and what's contributing to that already, and then work out their next steps by way of a team action plan that will help them to make progress. And it brings things like their targets to life. So if they've got numerical targets, which of course they all do, it brings them to life because they can actually notice the difference that tells them they're on track, etc. But when it comes to the reluctant team member, it also allows the manager to then go to that team member and say, okay, you've been part of this process. We've created this plan together. We all now know what direction we're going in. Are you with us? And of course, some of them will be, because some of them are just frustrated because they just don't know where they're going. Others, of course, if they're not, well, okay, well, we need to help you be successful somewhere else then, because the rest of the team is going this way. And if you don't want to come with us, that's fine, but we're not going to wait for you. And the team leaders absolutely love this because it's giving them something which is actually working with the willing and dealing with the reluctant member. And possibly fixes the reluctant member, or possibly helps the reluctant member to go away. And so I'm getting really, really good feedback that people who are using that are finding it very, very helpful. So those two things are, I think, the key to improving productivity in the NHS. And those are the things which are being enabled by solution-focused practice.
Andrew, I feel like you've already given us so much already. Is there anything that you would like to, impart, people listening to this?
Well, something which I'm told has been really, really useful in the training is I've come up with a very, very simple visual aid for describing solution-focused practice. And I use this to introduce solution-focused practice. So this is my take on it. We usually find ourselves using solution-focused practice when somebody comes and presents with a problem. And I put up on the screen a red square. And I said the red square represents the problem. Now, the traditional approach to tackling the problem is to analyze the problem. So why didn't we catch any wild boar tonight? Let's set up a committee, let's do some analysis, let's spend a lot of time and energy on working out why we didn't find wild boar. But actually, what's happening is that the problem is obscuring the view of what we want, which is represented in this visual model by a green circle. And a little green circle appears that you can only just see behind the red box. And I say, so in solution-focused practice, what we do is we don't worry about the red box, we worry about the green circle. And so the next thing that appears is a big green circle. And I explain that what we want to do is to focus on what we want and get a rich description of what we want. And then the red box appears again on the screen in front of the green circle. And I say, look, so the problem is still there, but we can now see more of what we want. And maybe we will find ways of getting some of what we want, even while the problem is still there. Okay. So what we want is, well, we want to eat something because we want to be satisfied. We want to satisfy our hunger. Okay, so now we can think of other ways of eating them. We still have a problem that we need to be able to track wild boar because we really fancy wild boar, but we're not going to do it while we're hungry. We're going to get some food first, and then maybe we can come back to the wild boar conundrum. And then the third stage is to say, so I haven't got a description of what we want. Sometimes that is enough. That's rapid solution-focused practice. Sometimes that's enough. But what we also do in solution-focused practice is we look for the useful interactions. We look for the other people who are involved in what we want, the other people who will notice a difference from what we want. So we in an organization, again, okay, what are the other teams that we're talking about here? What will they notice? What about the boss? What about colleagues? What about patients, etc.? And then we flesh the green circle out into a green sphere. And then the red box appears again, but this time the red box is smaller because we really are now moving away from the problem that God is considering this. We've now got lots of resources, lots of opportunities to make progress, and this is how solution-focused practice works. And that red box, green circle, visual aid seems to help, especially in the moment of, okay, somebody's hitting me with a problem, right? That's the red box. Okay, I need to think about the green circle, bang. And it's that mindset shift in the moment that seems to be the most helpful thing. And then the other element which ties into this is, as we've already spoken about, when the challenge we have in using this is that most of the conversations that we have are about doing things. Yeah. So what are we going to do about the wild boar problem? Well, I don't know. Okay, well, you better come up with an answer. That's not a helpful conversation, but that's a typical conversation. And if you substitute wild boar for all of the things that are going on in the world in terms of politics and so on, and you know, global conflict and climate change and all the rest of it, all the conversations are about, well, we must be doing something about it. And as soon as you say we're going to do something about it, there's somebody else who says, well, I disagree. We think we should do something else. So the doing of something contributes to the red box. And if instead of asking, what do we want to do, we drop the to do and we ask, what do we want instead, that's contributing to the green circle. And that is how I explain solution-focused practice. And for me, that is just the essence. That's it. Okay. Now, I know that we have a lot of tools that we use, and I do train people, miracle question, I train them scaling, I train them instances and exceptions, and so on. For me, they are tools. Other people use those tools as well. And I'm happy to have this debate with any solution-focused practice colleague. Scaling, miracle questions, so on, are not solution-focused practice. They are tools that we use to structure the conversation that I've just described. And what I've just described is what makes solution-focused practice different. And here's an opportunity for us all as well. In the useful interactions element is social capital. And social capital, I try and cover in my second book, the Make Life Simple. Well, I need to do more on this because it does fascinate me. Social capital is your narrative in your network, okay? And the easy example I give of that is, we probably all know retired people in our communities who are really, really active. Yeah, they're on committees, they're busy, they're always out and about. And you find out how old they are, and you can't believe it because they look 10 years younger. Yeah. They have high social capital. They have a narrative in their network. They're getting appreciation, so they're getting the dopamine hit from appreciation. They are, you know, people are always getting in touch with them just because they're helpful, useful people. I think a lot of us in the solution-focused practice community are like that because we are helpful, useful people, and we want to help people. And in the NHS especially, people are not in the NHS for the pay and the benefits. They're there because they want to help people. So, you know, this really appeals to them. We also obviously know there's lots of cases of people who sadly live in isolation for whatever reason. They have no or low social capital, and they usually end up with lots of health complications, and tragically, a lot of them will die before their time. So social capital is a resource, and here we are with the system of identifying it and quantifying it in conversation and allowing people to access it as a resource. I don't know any other practice that does that. So those are the things for me that is the essence of solution-focused practice, and that's what I'm training. And people can grab hold of that and can use it really, really simply. And I do worry sometimes that we are trying to overcomplicate solution-focused practice. But forgive me, I've been rambling on for a long time now, but because there's another thing to add to this. I think by trying to overcomplicate solution-focused practice, we're trying to play everybody else's game because that's how everybody else is making money. Okay. So I'm working in this NHS trust, like I say, and they are training lots and lots of other things. And one, for example, is crucial conversations. Have you heard of crucial conversations? Yeah. Okay. So crucial conversations is, as the title suggests, is a method of helping people with tough conversations. And there's a best-selling book. It sold 4 million copies according to the front cover. And they're training this in the NHS. And I've nothing against this method. You know, if it works, fine. You know, one of our principles is if it works, do more of it. But when I talk to my trainees about things like crucial conversations, what they all say is, yeah, it was great on the training, but I really struggle to use it because it's just too complicated. And what I think is happening is, or what has happened over the years, is that that essence of solution-focused practice that I've just described, I think that's actually at the heart of most common sense methods of helping people. But you don't make any money from that. So instead, people who want to make money want some intellectual property. So they create a model which often works, but the complexity is their intellectual property. So they can then go and trademark it and license it and make lots of money from it. And that's fine. That's the way then, fortunately or unfortunately, that's the way that society works. We all have to make money to survive. But what it means is that there's lots and lots and lots of complicated system-based approaches with structures and, clever abbreviations that make words and things. When people try and use them in the real world, they fall apart because not everybody in the room is using them. Yeah. And if you just take solution-focused practice and take the essence of solution-focused practice and realize that it is just common sense codified and quantifying your social capital, it suddenly becomes really easy to use. And you can use it in the moment. You can use it anywhere. You can use it bringing up your kids. You can use it organizing the Christmas night out. You can use it in your organization. A lot of the people I'm training in the NHS, even though I'm training it organizationally, are using it clinically because they can't help themselves because they've got their head in this mindset now of, well, why would I do it that way when I can do it this way and it's better? It just works. And I'm not teaching them, I am teaching them scaling, I am teaching them a miracle question, but I'm actually saying, yeah, you might want to use this to structure the conversation, but it's optional. You don't have to use it to have a solution-focused conversation. And I'm on a mission to keep SF really, really simple because I think that's where the nugget of gold is. And nobody else has that. We've got that, we quantify that, we're proud of it. Other people look at that and go, yeah, I'm not gonna make any money from that. And so they go and do something else. There you go.
Cool.
That's my theory. No doubt you will get some comments along that, and I'm open to challenge and open to conversations. If you want anyone wants to debate me on a stage on this one, very happy to be debated.
Another podcast episode.
Love it. So here's what's buzzing through my head because Dion said, what's something that our listeners can go away and try? So, what's something that they could go away and do instead of what they're doing, or something that they could go and do differently?
It's that essence of, okay, if you're in a situation, what do we want? That one question, what do we want? Not what do we want to do? Okay, what do we want? You can be with your kids, okay? Your kids can be fighting and you need to sort this out as a parent. Okay, what do we want? We want them to be calm and to be playing nicely. Okay. So have they been doing that recently? Yes, they have. Okay. So we can either wade in as parents do and separate them and say, rah, 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 and we are just raising the volume ourselves. Or we can remind them that 5 minutes ago they were playing nicely. Can you just do that again, please? Yeah. Remember what we want. What do we want is the fundamental question that should be the first question that we ask. What do we want? And it's that direction of travel. Because I'm doing a lot of training, I've got lots and lots of examples I use. One of my favorites is, so we get into the taxi at the station, yeah? What does the taxi driver ask us?
Where do you want to
Yeah. So what if we said, oh, just take me away from here? What would the taxi driver ask us?
So true.
What would the taxi driver ask us? Well, they'd probably ask us where we want to go. And if we kept on just saying, oh, just take me away from here, the next question, how much money have you got? Because if you're not going to tell me where you want to go, no problem. I will just drive you until your money runs out. So how much money have you got? Okay. And then they'll drive you until your money runs out and then they'll drop you off. And they will have given you what you wanted. And then you'd be like, well, I don't want to be here. Well, you didn't tell me where you wanted. We would never ever do that with the taxi driver. We would always tell them where we wanted to go, and they would take us to where we wanted to go. And that direction of travel in a conversation is so important. So for any team leader, any manager, if your team is hitting you with a problem, okay, what do we want? And you, in all honesty, I don't think you can make progress until you've worked out what you want. And you've got to have that description of what you want. A lot of the time, problems are created by the rush to do something, to be seen to be doing something about a problem. Yeah, especially governmentally, especially in politics. This happens all the time. So I think it's really helpful in those tiny situations where your colleague has come in with a problem, right up to global conflict that's occupying a lot of time and a lot of space at the moment. It just helps you to keep a sense of perspective, and the awareness of the passage of time is something else that I train, because we are time travelers. We take people forward to their perfect future. We come back to the here and now in the recent past, and then we look at a little short distance into the future for their next steps. So we are travel. We're traveling in time. We are Doctor Who consultants. It's fantastic, and I think that's worth paying gazillions of dollars for, frankly.
I
That's
agree.
fantastic. So much to digest. I'm looking forward to listening to this back and thinking some more about those things. I love the simplicity. I love the simplicity, and I think it's so true. Jason, did you have something?
I was going to say the same thing. I was going to say I love common sense codified and the quantifying of social capital. Beautiful.
Yeah, thank you. I think that really is what we do. And it's beholden upon us as the keepers of the solution-focused practice flame to keep it simple. And my message to any solution-focused practitioners who are listening to this is that by overcomplicating it, we actually make it harder for people to access solution-focused practice. And I think when we try and play the same game as all those other practices, all those other methods, where there is intellectual property and there is complication, we're just playing somebody else's game. And we're playing a completely different game. And we know that it works when we keep it simple. And in its essence is its simplicity. So let's keep it that way, and let's be proud of that. And yeah, it's tough to make money as a solution-focused practitioner, but you know what? There's no shortage of clients. Yeah. And if you are helping people in one session and word gets out, this is the stuff you both read URP. If your reputation, your story, and your narrative in your network is that you help people in one session, you'll get people re recommending you to others to say, oh, you need to talk to Jason, you need to talk to Dion. They helped me in one session. They were amazing. Yeah. Okay. You will get lots and lots of clients. So you might not make as much money per client, but you'll get lots of clients and you'll do fine. Yeah. And the simplicity is the essence. And when we disappear into our own world, debating one tool versus another tool, the use of language here versus the use of language there, that's really interesting. And of course, it's worthy, but it doesn't help us to get the message out there that what we've got here is, as you say, Jason, it's the codification of common sense and the quantifying of social capital. And those are amazing. Common sense and social capital. Wow, that's what makes the world work. Yeah. We have insight and understanding into how the world works. I think that's pretty good.
Absolutely. And look, they're your words, Andrew. You don't, thank you for crediting me with them. They're your words. My simplest way of describing it to people is meaningful change faster. And it is because it's the one size fits one, not one size fits all. So it's meaningful. They get a sense of what they're going to do next once they've got the direction.
And that's the difference that people want as well. So that's not talking about how you're going to do it. That's the, if somebody is in a situation where they want stuff to change, where you're going to give them meaningful change faster. Yeah, great.
Fantastic. Well, I have certainly enjoyed this conversation, and I think we might have to tee up a sequel, because I think there's a wealth of wisdom and knowledge. Yeah, definitely some standouts, keeping it simple. I think it's so true. Where can we get you? Where's the best place to get your books? And you know, where else can we find out more about you, or you know, follow what you're up to?
So the books are available through online bookstores. So choose your online bookstore wisely, but it's available on quite a lot of them. The thing I'm working on at the moment, which hopefully will be coming soon, I've recorded a 14-module video version of the training that I do. And I'm busy away trying to get that in a form where people can access that. So that's my current project in terms of getting it out there. The more people for me that can access the simplicity of this method, the better. And yeah, so that's and you can always get in touch with me through my website, andrew-gibson.com. Nice and easy to remember, andrew-gibson.com. Is there should anybody want to reach out, get in touch. And yeah, one last little plug. I'm leading the organizing team for the UK Association for Solution Focused Practice 2025 conference in Bradford in July, 17th and 18th of July, with pre-conference training on the 16th. The theme of the conference is doing more with less. You'll see a pattern from this conversation. Thanks to Petra Mulă-Dumari in Romania for that one. People want to do more with less right now, so that's what we can offer with solution focused practice. So let's have a conference that helps people do more with less, where they discover solution focused practice. That's the plan. And we can welcome more people to the family. So if anybody's coming over to the UK for a summer holiday in July, then make sure you check out the UK Association website and come along and say hi.
Awesome.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jason. Thank you, Dion, and thank you very much for inviting me onto your podcast, and it's been great fun. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on the Towards Solutions podcast. We hope today's insights inspire you to apply solution focus in your life and projects. Whether you're applying these strategies in your personal life, professional practice, or community projects, we're excited to see the impact you create.
If you found this episode helpful, please share it with others who might benefit from our discussions. Your support helps us to reach more people and continue to bring you quality content. Stay tuned for more enlightening conversations, and make sure you subscribe, and let's continue this journey towards solutions together.